Yes, please carry on.
I'd been married in July of this summer up in Scotland, and my wife came to stay.
This is July 41?
Yes. No, this was by this time it was 42.
42.
And she came to live in the pub. I'm afraid I may have slipped a year there by mistake. But we met, certainly met in 42, and she came to live in a pub, and it was called Docking, which was actually the name of the satellite. We all our night flying from a satellite aerodrome, and this was Docking, which I know is there today because I paid it a visit quite recently. And the owner of the pub was Mr. Bill Jacobs. Where are you now, Bill? Because also living in the pub was the village policeman, who was a friend, and he came in. This is Molly's description. He came in for breakfast and said, one of those damned aircraft has crashed in the field. And the pub keeper's wife guessed it immediately and kicked him under the table. And said, so he pushed off, and it was me. Wasn't it marvellous? And I was picked up and taken back to the base and dropped off at the pub, so everything was okay. By this time it was daylight, of course.
So you were flying from Norfolk.
Yes.
You were mining enemy ports.
Or convoys.
Or attempting to torpedo convoys.
Yes.
You attempted to torpedo this convoy, where you then made an attack, but you almost ran out of fuel as you got back to the UK.
Yeah.
How frequent was this sort of operation?
The mining was done even twice a week, but I'll say once a week. We were moved from there after my experience. It was reckoned that we were, you know, there was no room for error at all. And on that night in particular, when I got back, one of the other aircraft had gone to the shortest route to England, which is Essex.
I'm sorry, your wife was making lunch arrangements there. Please continue, I'm sorry.
I do know the night that I ran out, taking the long way home, one or two of our aircraft took the shortest route back to England, and they ended somewhere in Essex, I think it was, or Suffolk, I don't remember where. And then, so we were taken away from there, and as a squadron, we moved to Thorney Island, near Chichester, and proceeded to mine Cherbourg, Le Havre, and even somewhere else. I can't think of anywhere further. But we did. We mined the French harbours, where we knew U-boats were. We also carried out, all at night, anti-E-boat patrols right down to Ushant, which is a very long way away. And we normally sent aircraft down to somewhere in Cornwall first, and then sent them from there. So we covered the English Channel pretty well. And I personally mined the harbours in the Channel Islands, which the Germans either kept their E-boats or their U-boats. I think it was E-boats there.
Would you have said that the Swordfish was the right sort of aircraft for this operation? It seems if it's doing only 90 or 100 knots, that it's fairly slow, vulnerable aircraft. Would that be right or wrong?
Yes, but of course we were safe in darkness, more or less. But you're quite right. It wasn't airborne for a very long time, 4 or 5 hours. But that was quite enough for the aircrew. My brother, as I said, was flying a Liberator, and nothing less than 10 hours. So from that point of view, and doing only that speed, it couldn't cover a lot of areas. But I believe we did that job extremely well. Any other Royal Air Force aeroplane, the nearest to it perhaps, was something like the I've forgotten his name now, a two-engine plane, But as I pointed out to my brother, he had a crew of 7 and 4 engines, but carried no more armaments than I did in my Swordfish, with 1 engine and crew of 2. So from that point of view, it was highly economical.
What did your other 2 crew members do?
One was a navigator, and we had pretty good navigation equipment, I think. It was called ASV, and we could pick up land and, of course, ships, which was intended, at about 25 or 30 miles.
This was a form of radar, airborne radar.
Airborne radar, yes, the best way to describe it. So from that point of view, I never any doubt about finding my way back to England, for example. But I got a bit nervous out in the middle of the Atlantic, because you've got to get within 25 or 30 miles of your ship. And any error in navigation, you weren't going to make it. So I was quite happy with these operations that night. I went to Cherbourg 3 times when we were from Thorny Island to drop mines in the entrance, and myself. And if I may go on a little bit to my... When I captained a frigate, I had to pay an official visit to Cherbourg and make a speech in French. So I described the fact that I had been here before, and as I came through the entrance, I wondered whether one of my... The French for mine is mean. Whether this was going to go off. And this was received as amusement, actually.
Of course, yes.
I think, actually, one of the French liners was in there as well. But certainly never came out. So that was that. And then, of course, as I said, the biter was back in England. And in that December 42, I've got the year right now, we joined HMS Biter.
Now, HMS Biter was an escort carrier.
Okay, converted merchant ship, yes.
Well, that's half my question answered. Presumably that's an escort carrier is a little small aircraft carrier.
Small thing, yes.
Which is really not an aircraft carrier at all, but in this case was a converted...
Converted merchant ship.
And how many aircraft would it take?
Well, I thought they did very well indeed, because we had 12 Swordfish, and we also had 3 or 4 fighters. It doesn't matter which, because I can't remember exactly. So what you might ask is what the fighters were for. Well, in the meantime, the Germans had put anti-aircraft guns on their U-boats, and had they succeeded in shooting down... one of our Swordfish. So the idea now was, when we went on patrol, you either took a fighter with you, or you had one at immediate readiness, and you'd go front gun attack, and I carried 2 of these attacks, and the fighters, which were Martlets, if you know the type, American, with 0.5 guns, tore into this U-boat with his guns, and I came in and dropped my depth charges, as they were in those days, and she came to the surface and was sunk by an escort. That's the whole story, but it took about 6 hours.
Well, take me through that then, if you would.
Yes.
That day that you were involved in sinking a U-boat, can you take me through it, please?
Yes. We were with a convoy.
You were on HMS
Biter.
Biter.
And we were actually in the convoy. The practice of having us in the convoy was also new. In the previous time, in early February, we'd kept away from the convoys and sent our aircraft to escort the convoy. And very often that was half an hour totally wasted. Put the two together, an hour totally wasted. So we operated in the middle of the convoy, and this was all arranged by, of course, the control people. The control of shipping. And the convoys were rearranged, so they had a nice little box, empty box, in the middle. So I would take off from there, staying inside the convoy, and zoom off, usually in the direction that an escort had either seen or picked up a U-boat transmission. A U-boat transmissions were very, very important. Because if a U-boat saw a convoy, he couldn't resist telling the control, which happened to be the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Do you remember that?
I didn't know that.
Yes, it was. They controlled U-boats from the Eiffel Tower. And they'd bash out very short signals, but our ships were equipped called the Y Office. I don't know why it was called the Y Office, but it was called the Y Office. Good name for it, actually. We would pick up their transmissions, and they didn't know that we were doing this. And the sort of thing you had to keep quiet about. Anyway, if a U-boat said, bleep, 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 it was picked up by us, we would send off an escort, if it was 20 or 30 miles away, and we'd wind up a swordfish and send it down the same track. Of course, we got there long before the escort. With a bit of luck, you found it on the surface. But a bit of luck.
Using your radar first.
Yeah, using ASV first, yes. And we'd home on this, and they wouldn't know we were there. Because whatever their ship's radar consisted of, I don't think they had any, would not have picked up the swordfish until it was close visibility. But if it started attacking, they now had these anti-aircraft guns, and two of our aircraft were shot down. Not present. So by the time I did my operation with them, if we weren't picking on a swordfish, we did a patrol around the convoy. You would take it off, swordfish first, the fighter would come later and join you and follow you, because the fighter had no navigational aids whatsoever.
So this fighter, which could fly at 300 knots, had to fly at 100?
One had to fly at 100, yeah. Which he could do with his nose well up. And if he wanted to go a bit quicker, he would...
Zigzag a bit.
And then on sighting, I did this twice, I can't remember exactly when. I'm sorry I haven't got my logbook, but it's gone to the grandsons. Which really says attach... U-boat, fighter attack, U-boat dropped three depth charges, which is what we normally carry. And I learned subsequently that the escort had picked them up and sunk the U-boat. We would take off, we hopefully see the U-boat, because it was always very exciting. By the way, the RT code for the U-boat was Hearse.
Hearse?
Hearse, yes. And you said very quickly, Hearse on service. And whoever chose that word chose it really well. And when I was on the ground or in the ship, I could hear the office officer saying, "What?" And the pilot came up, "Hearse, Hearse." Which was very exciting for us. If we picked that one, we would expect to sink it.
Would you? So on this particular day, you were on standby on the deck.
Yes.
Not airborne, but just
standby.
Waiting.
Yep.
Someone in the convoy picks up a signal from a U-boat.
Or us, or we picked it up, yes.
And, or you may have done, and you get the order to take off.
Yes.
Can you take me on that day, the day that you ultimately sunk a U-boat or were part of sinking a U-boat, can you take me through what happened on that day?
Yes. We had a very scroll. It used to be called the aircrew restroom, but in fact it's the aircrew ready room. So that's where you sat and the fighter pilot sat. And it was very comfortable. Anything that was happening, you could pick it up on the ship's SRE sound reproduction equipment. And there you were ready, dressed. And if you were called to man your aircraft, which is what you were, you scuppered out on the deck. The ground crew were there already, and would probably have started the engine. And it was the fitter's job to start the engine. And you had to remember to... there was a special tank on the swordfish which you started the engine with, and he had to remember to switch it over to the main tank, otherwise you run out of petrol in 5 minutes. And he'd be there, and he'd strap you in, and strap the crew in the back. By this time, the observer would be in contact on RT with the operations room in the ship. And we had the most powerful radar and detection equipment as well. The only other ships like to have it were any HM ships with the convoy, big ones like a cruiser. Or the Commodore of convoys, the Commodore sometimes had a direction finder. But we were the only powerful and reliable one. And then we would wind up the engine and the ship could turn into wind inside the box of the convoy, so we didn't go wandering outside where the U-boats were perhaps poised. And you take off and fly at about 1,500 feet down the direction that you were given by the ship. And you, needless to say, well, I won't say needless to say, an escort would be detached at the same time. And I maybe had 30 or 40 miles to fly. And he would come grinding up behind me. And if it was on the surface, in the early days, we would go straight in and drop depth charges on it. On this occasion, I waited for the fighter. And he came down.
So you found it on your radar, but held back without him knowing that he had been spotted.
That's right, yes. And he had no, the Germans had no radar that I know of, ever. Although we did have it in our submarines. So they were waiting for us to be visual if anything was coming. So they had a pretty good lookout. And we were visible. Not very far away. I mean, 10 miles at the most. You'd see this little airplane wobbling along.
So you had to stay more than 10 miles away?
No, we went straight in.
Did you?
As quick as we could, yes. Because they often didn't dive before we attacked. And if you caught them diving, that's well, because they left the trail, you see, where they go. And on this occasion, we started on the surface. He then dived, because I know it wasn't on the surface when I dropped my depth charges. But you could see the swell, and I dropped the depth charges there. And they had a fairly effective range, but not more than about 25 yards.
The depth charge had to be dropped within 25 yards of
to show any sort of...
Any sort of damage?
Damage, yes.
What, how big were they? Or?
Well, I have to move on a bit from the early ones, which was a big one, which was 500 pounds weight. We'd take two of those, but with the later ones, which were 250 pounds, you would carry two on each wing, which is four. And you try to drop all four in a string. That's what we were trained to do. And our training has included the imaginary attack on a U-boat diving, which we did in the Clyde with our own U-boats, our own submarines. Of course, we didn't drop any live depth charges, we drive spec plates. And the submarine used to report how close they were.
Yeah.
We got pretty good at it, actually. So
you just mentioned smoke plates.
Well, when we were doing the training, we dropped the smoke flares and not a depth charge. And this could be seen by the submarine through his periscope. And he would report how close they were. So that was our training with real live submarines in the first attack. And you got pretty good at it. You know, submarine on surface, submarine dives. We go into the attack and drop our smoke flares in the cloud. And our depth charges at sea.
How long did a submarine, a U-boat, take to get down so that it was no longer leaving a trail, so that it was now invisible?
I'd hate to usurp a U-boat commander or even our own submarine commander's view, but I would say about half a minute.
Half a minute?
Hmm.
So you yourself can only fly 800 yards in half a minute.
Yes.
So, you had to get right up to this U-boat before he spotted you.
Yes, pretty close, probably spotted me. And then, of course, he was diving. But there's no... if he was on the surface, they got confident to shoot us down. And we were then also re-equipped with rockets. Unfortunately, not operation that I took part in. But one of the U-boats was hit by our aircraft and surfaced, and the whole crew were taken prisoner. The U-boat crew were taken prisoner. And in a very simple interrogation in the escort, he revealed that our depth charges had been extremely close, and the U-boat would not have been able to take another attack. But the escort actually sank it. Having taken all the crew off. But we didn't discover that until we got to Canada. We were we convoyed to Halifax, in Nova Scotia.
So you would convoy right across. You didn't convoy to the middle and meet another convoy and turn round in that
we
way.
We did that once or twice. When I say once or twice, don't forget that I was doing this for several months.
Yes.
And we certainly went certainly far across to pick up a convoy and bring it back to England. But we rather liked going to Halifax in Canada. What, with no food rationing, no blackout? We were frustrated. I'd turn round and come back to England with another convoy.
Yes.
Which are, of course, much more important and much more exciting.
The ones coming over were much more important than the ones.
Yes, because U-boats were targeting them rather more than the ones going the other way.
Yes, of course.
But so it was some relief when we were released by the Commodore. And of course, we homed up to Clyde. We also went to Iceland a couple of times. But our first operation, which was to go and meet a convoy, we went to Halifax and then to Iceland and anchored in there in the Elfjord, and which was made even more exciting because the Bismarck came out at that time, and we hastily avoided any contact with it. The Bismarck. And the ships concerned were in Belfjord in Iceland. So we got fairly familiar with the Atlantic.
Yes. Now, if I may, we've had a break. If I may, can I take you back to the sinking of this U-boat? Before we go off to other things, I think we went off to Iceland and to other places. if I could take you back to the sinking of this U-boat, you got the signal that it was on the surface. You were ready in your aircraft and you took off and the fighter followed you.
Yeah.
Can you actually tell me, if you like, can you talk me through the rest of the events until the escort sank it?
We went where we were directed, but from the operations room in the base, so they must have picked up this message in the first place, which had clearly sent a message indicating it was on, not only was it on the surface, but it had sighted our convoy. And this process was used once or twice. So I went off in this direction. I went where I was sent. And the U-boat was on the surface. And they saw me, obviously, but the fighter went in. The Nautic went in and sprayed it with the front gun, whereupon the U-boat dived. But this time I was still 3 or 4 miles away. It leaves a very conspicuous swirl, which is what we were trained to expect. At the same time, the observer, having seen the diving, had started to time it. So when it went down, and we were able to, I had 2 500-pound depth charges on, and I dropped these over the swell as best as I could. I mean, didn't know which way the submarine had turned underneath, and then I legged it back. In the meantime, we had called up an escort as to where this submarine was. And I do remember that the escort also attacked. I just remember, as I turned back to the carrier, like I was fairly high up, I saw the escort dropping a pattern of depth charges that he did in those days. And we subsequently learned that it had been sunk. And of course, the escort claimed the victim. And that's the drama of that particular incident.
And that was in the autumn of 1942?
No, I didn't go to, we joined the ship at the end of 42, but didn't go to sea until 43. So this would have been March, April.
That was at the height of the U-boat.
Absolutely. We were just breaking them then, and And we got the reports on where the U-boats were, and they all moved down south towards the Azores. All of them. How many we recorded, I don't know. But it was understood that they were arming themselves with anti-aircraft guns. So the mere fact that we'd driven them all back to harbour was a considerable achievement in itself in the anti-submarine war.
Yes.
And we ourselves were then fitted with rockets. But I never did a rocket attack on a U-boat. I'm sorry to say that they didn't. But they were done by one of our aircraft.
So Swordfish were fitted with rockets in the summer of 1943?
Yes. I'll say early summer, because obviously we were...
Sure.
I was there in the early summer.
And these were thought to be better means of defeating U-boats if you caught them on the surface.
It was a method of sinking them on the surface. And it became very relevant because they had anti-aircraft guns. In other words, they weren't going to dive. But if we had a weapon which could hit them on the surface. I don't know where the science of this came from, but we felt much better armed with rockets than we did with...
Did you?
Just our ears.
Yes.
Because you could fire these things at 1,000 yards.
Could you? And how accurate were they over 1,000 yards?
Extremely accurate, insofar as they were extremely easy to launch. You had to be at more or less the right angle, which is pretty steep in the first place, in order to get the 90 degrees you want on the side of the thing. And I don't know all our practice runs. Unfortunately, I never did a live one. You aimed it at the cunning tower, which is very prominent.
Yes.
And when you reckon you're at the right range, you press the tip. It was usually before the anti-aircraft guns that opened up. It was obviously marginal, which was first.
Yes. Yes.
Although I did lots of practice firings in the Clyde or Scotland, I never fired one in anger.
So we are now into the summer of 1943.
That's right, yes.
You have just been trained and refitted with torpedo firing Swordfish.
Yes.
What then happened in your career?
Well, of course, we had this break with these Chesapeake 2s. Our appointment at the end of our training was a great change in our lives. And I suppose I was excited going to Chesapeake was a modern aircraft. And that was in Leon 7th. And we did intensive. this is still 42, if I got it right. Yes, but intensive. Dive bombing, based at Leon 7th. And I either got the impression, or it was a fact, that we were there to meet invasion. In 1942.
Invasion in 1942?
Yeah. We were there to counter invasion. That the dive bomb was the aircraft you wanted. Not supporting our invasion, but the German invasion.
And so it was still thought in some quarters that the Germans might attempt an invasion of the United Kingdom in 42.
Yes. And I either learnt or was told, or absorbed it somewhere, that our dive bomber squadron was there at Leon 7 for that purpose.
Right.
And I certainly never landed this Chesapeake on an aircraft carrier. No. Because we converted back to Swordfish and planning for an escort carrier in the Atlantic. One of which coming to England being converted in American port from merchant ships. I'm afraid it was sunk on the way. And which was why we went to the RAF for something to do with a frontline squadron.
So from the early summer of 1943, how did your career then proceed?
Well, obviously I stayed in this carrier until August. It so happened, because by that time, I had done 2 years concentrated operational flying. And I was rather attracted to the specialists he's got an air gunnery officer, which is involved a short course at Weyland in the gunnery school to learn all about armaments. So I applied for it, and the captain said, well, you've been in the squadron for 2 years, I think this is a good time for you to go ashore. So I went to the air gunnery course at Weyland in Portsmouth, and from after that I went to an air station in Lancashire, just in Lancashire, or just in Cheshire, and it was called Stretton, near Liverpool. And was therefore what the RAF would call the station armament officer. I was